Hello, this is Tom Averill. I'm at High Plains Public Radio, joining the book club with my own Carol Dickens Christmas. I am a writer in residence and professor of English at Washburn University in Topeka, where I've taught for 36 years. I'm also, of course, as writer in residence, a writer and novelist. And we're going to talk about A. Carol Dickens Christmas, my most recent novel, the fourth novel that I've written, my ninth book. And wanted to turn to the subject of food. One of my favorite things as a writer to evoke food. My very first novel, which is called Secrets of the Till Cafe, has 26 recipes for New World food, cooked New Mexican style. And so part of what infused this book with some of its energy is Carol's passion for food. Carol Dickens has a passion that keeps her engaged, that gives her something to do besides worry and besides worry about the transition and the empty nest. She loves cooking, and my novel contains her recipes for the five meals that she feels she has discovered in Dickens' A Christmas Carol. I'll give you an example of how she feels when she's cooking. This is the Scrooge meal, and you might remember that after Scrooge refuses to be charitable with anybody, he goes to a tavern, a dingy place, and eats a bit of beef and an underdone potato and so on. Carol checked on the rump of beef she'd transferred from the slow cooker to a large pot where it would boil until it shredded when nudged with a fork. In the back of the refrigerator, she found her English mustards, a Coleman original and the one with horseradish made by Cottage Delight. She opened the jars for the coppery smell. Mustards never seemed to spoil. She found the French's American for Finn in its fat yellow barrel and put it on the table with the others. The potatoes were next, already peeled and cut into chunks, soaking in a bowl of water. Carol added them to the boiling beef, then rummaged in her bottom cabinets for the Dutch oven she used once a year to toast cheese. She poured a quarter of an inch of Witchwood's Hobgoblin traditional English ale. Finn liked the name, Carol liked the taste, and then she finished the rest of the bottle. She rummaged in the meat drawer for the white cheddar she'd bought and discovered half of it already gone. In the pantry, Finn muttered throaty endearments to Scraps, who had no doubt wolfed down the cheese. Let the dog be happy. The remaining chunk would be plenty. She took the crackers from their plastic bag. She'd made them the night before, as she liked cooking even the smallest necessities from scratch, at least at Christmas time. Finally, as the ale began to simmer, Carol sliced the cheese to cover the bottom and watched it melt. She portioned beef and potatoes and crackers onto small plates. When the cheese bubbled, she quickly spooned it onto the crackers and hurried to the table. She and Finn dotted the meager fare with mustard and ate. The meal was simple, but nothing about it was Scroogey, except for Finn. Well, Carol has these five meals that she prepares, and this was a late addition to my writing of the novel, and I had to suddenly do a bunch of research into Victorian cooking, which was interesting. It turns out that there are two volumes, both by Cedric Dickens, who is the grandson of Charles Dickens. One is called Dining with Dickens, and it's an average-sized book, and one is called Drinking with Dickens, and it's an above-average-sized book. Wonderful recipes in there. And then I also found a history professor at Johnson County Community College who does food history, a woman named Andrea Broomfield, who wrote a wonderful article called The Last Meals on the Titanic. And it's not just a look at what people had in their stomachs as they went down, of course, on that fatal night, but it's also an example of looking at an ocean liner and a luxury liner and seeing what first-class passengers ate versus second-class versus third-class, plus the people who actually worked on the boat. So they all had different meals before they went down. So it's really an exploration of class in early 20th century. So at any rate, Andrea was very helpful and showed me some on Google Books, some of the very earliest cookbooks from Victorian time. I also had family help with some of the meals. One time we decided we'd do a Cratchit meal for Christmas. And I made a goose, and my sister-in-law made a gran pudding, even using suet for the fat in it. She had to convince the butcher she was wanting the suet to feed birds and not to make puddings in Dickensian style. We had chestnuts, oranges, and we had not very much food because we wanted to experience the Cratchit meal. And so, you know, food, when you experience it, it's one thing to experience it, it's another thing to write it down. But I've tried to do that so that everybody can experience this food. And then if I haven't, there's always the recipes. And Carol Dickens, in the course of the book, remembers her first Cratchit meal cooked with her friend Frida, who is away during the action of A Carol Dickens Christmas. But it's just a month after her husband Caldwell has left her. And here's her research into the Cratchit meal. She and Finn had gone to the university library. Charles Dickens' great-grandson Cedric, it turned out, had published Dining with Dickens with an entire chapter on Christmas, and for backup, Carol found Eliza Acton's Modern Cookery for Private Families, an 1845 compendium of how 19th-century English people cooked and ate. The recipes were called receipts. How often Carol had been admonished by Caldwell to keep your receipts. Screw Caldwell, she had thought. She had kept her own kind of receipts, the ones for food and not income taxes. Screw Caldwell, her friend Frida had echoed. Christmas is for merriment, not for humbugs like your soon-to-be ex. With Frida, everything was soon-to-be. Carol was soon to be fully divorced, soon to be happy, soon to be finding her own rituals, soon to be learning more about herself, exploring her own tastes, adjusting to single life and single motherhood. Frida and Carol shopped together and bought one small goose, two large potatoes, two apples to cook down to sauce, one onion, and a loaf of bread for stuffing, one apple, one orange, and a dozen chestnuts. The basic meal was simple enough, but not the pudding. Cedric Dickens' simple receipt called for breadcrumbs and brown sugar, orange and lemon peel, spice, eggs, salt. Frida ran to the liquor store for rum and Guinness while Carol asked the butcher for suet. He seemed amused that she might actually use it for cooking and gave it to her for free. Carol searched for currants and sultanas and muscatels, three different names for grapes, as she'd found out. Currants were the small Mediterranean seedless, sultanas the seedless Asian minor, golden, muscatels the raisin of the sweet white muscat grape. All those grapes. No wonder the pudding was the centerpiece of the Christmas feast. Bread and grapes, the same ingredients as communion, only the bread crumbed and sweetened, the grapes dried instead of fermented. She and Frida had gone home to assemble the pudding, which sang in its steam for 5 hours. Carol felt the same anxiety as Mrs. Cratchit upon turning it out, and had the same rich reward. And, as Dickens wrote, she entered the dining room, flushed but smiling proudly, with the pudding, like a speckled cannonball, so hard and firm, blazing in half a quartern of ignited brandy, and bedight with Christmas holly stuck into the top. Oh, a wonderful pudding! Soon to be eaten, Frida exclaimed. Finn refused to eat it. Frida ate generously, especially the outer layer, immersed as it was in brandy. Carol ate a healthy portion, then cleared the pudding from the table. She did not let Finn's grumpiness affect her. Not this, her first Christmas after the separation, a Christmas brave in ribbons, as Dickens had written when life was in tatters. Carol served the apple and orange, the roasted chestnuts, which she helped Finn peel, and still he only ate a bite. She and Frida lifted their small toddies of gin and lemon, and Carol forced herself to say, "A Merry Christmas to us all. God bless us." Finn refused to say, "God bless us, everyone," though Carol had rehearsed him. Frida chimed in with the obligatory line. Standing in her red blouse and long green skirt, her wool socks and sandals showing her past as a flower child, Carol wondered how she'd have weathered the season without her friend. Carol blessed scraps with the skin of the goose. The next day, Carol had given her leftover pudding to Mr. Marble, who had come for a ladder from the carriage house. He hefted the foil, then brought it to his nose. "A Christmas pudding, you say," the old man had said, "right heavy enough, and with the proper smell of a drunkard's breath." I'm Tom Averill. I'm reading from a Carol Dickens Christmas here at High Plains Public Radio. We're talking about food in the novel. I think my favorite of all the feasts in the book, Carol Dickens Christmas and Charles Dickens A Christmas Carol, is the Fezziwig Feast, which is described in the book only very simply as cold roasted, cold boiled mince pies, negus, and beer. And of course, Fezziwig is the master that Scrooge was appointed to and worked for, apprenticed to when he was a young man. And here's how Carol feels about it. Carol loved the Fezziwig feast. Perhaps the ghost of Christmas past had said it best. 'Twas a small matter to make silly folks so full of gratitude. Yet Scrooge had insisted that the power of a master over apprentices was no small matter at all, nor was the power Carol might exercise. For 6 years she'd put fiddle music on the CD player, insisting on dancing with abandon, not even knowing steps, but stepping all the same, whirling and dervishing in the living room, hall, dining room, and kitchen. She embarrassed Finn with the manic energy of the evening, but she thought teenage boys ought to be embarrassed again and again by the women in their lives, until their boyish reticence, their hormonal awkwardness, their damnable self-consciousness, their timidity around bodies and bodily processes were all hammered out of them, and they could wring out their emotions without worrying what anyone else thought. Their embarrassment was like their pimples, a character builder that would disappear as they matured. Well, on this particular Carol Dickens Christmas Fezziwig feast, here's how the Fezziwig feast goes. Lawrence Timmons comes along. You'll remember he's enamored of Carol Dickens and trying to heat up their relationship. Finally, a taxi pulled into their drive and Lawrence wheeled himself into the house. Carol brought out the negus and Lawrence drank with gusto. When Carol reminded him he hadn't liked it before, Lawrence asked, "Can't we change?" Carol sighed and then remembered her Dickens, having some power toward making the evening happy or unhappy, light or burdensome, pleasure or toil, all from the smallest words and looks, things so slight and insignificant that it is impossible to add and count 'em up. So they brought out the cold boiled, and Carol cut the meat as thin as she could until Lawrence thought he could cut it thinner, which he did, until Finn insisted he could cut it thinnest of all. And Carol salted hers, and Lawrence peppered his, and Finn ate his plain, and Carol brought out the cold roasted, which they kept on the bone, enjoying the chance to use their fingers, enjoying the tearing of flesh still pink at the bone, wiping their hands on Carol's huge Christmas napkins before taking another swig of negus, though Finn kept to his half a cup, the negus complimenting the mince pies, as though they'd been born twins, and at some point negus had decided to become liquid and mince solid, and the flaky crust of the pies crumbed Lawrence's well-trimmed beard and dropped to their plates into the floor, and Carol rose to put on the fiddle music she'd readied for the occasion, and she couldn't help but spin and skip, hop and turn, her calves, as Dickens wrote, shining like moons. and Finn couldn't help but rise from his chair and cut a few steps himself, and Lawrence backed his wheelchair away and clapped his hands and shook his head, and surprising Carol gave a cheery whoop of pleasure at seeing mother and son dance, which they did through two jigs until their giddiness, as diminished as their breath, dissipated, and they sat again and found new appetite for the simplest of food. I'm Tom Averill, reading from A Carol Dickens Christmas. We're talking this part about food in A Carol Dickens Christmas, but also in Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. He was particularly enamored of food, I think, in this Christmas novel, in part because hunger and poverty are terrible things, especially they were during Dickens' time, when the Cratchits are having their impoverished meal. Bob Cratchit proposes a toast. He says, "I'll give you Mr. Scrooge, the founder of the feast." "The founder of the feast, indeed," cried Mrs. Cratchit, reddening. "I wish I had him here. I'd give him a piece of my mind to feast upon, and I hope he'd have a good appetite for it." "My dear," said Bob, "the children, Christmas Day." "It should be Christmas Day, I am sure," said she, "on which one drinks the health of such an odious, stingy, hard, unfeeling man as Mr. Scrooge. You know he is, Robert. Nobody knows it better than you do, poor fellow." "My dear," was Bob's mild answer, "Christmas Day." "I'll drink his health for your sake and the day's," said Mrs. Cratchit, "not for his. Long life to him. A Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. He'll be very merry and very happy, I have no doubt." The children drank the toast after her. It was the first of their proceedings, which had no heartiness. Tiny Tim drank it last of all, but he didn't care twopence for it. Scrooge was the ogre of the family. The mention of his name cast a dark shadow on the party, which was not dispelled for 5 full minutes. That's Charles Dickens, the Cratchits, on their impoverished meal, talking about Scrooge. But if that meal's impoverished, the ghost of Christmas present in Dickens is very rich with food. Here's how Dickens describes Scrooge's first look at the ghost of Christmas present. "Heaped up on the floor to form a kind of throne were turkeys, geese, game, poultry, brawn, great joints of meat, sucking pigs, long wreaths of sausages, mince pies, plum puddings, barrels of oysters, red-hot chestnuts, cherry-cheeked apples, juicy oranges, luscious pears, immense twelfth cakes, and seething bowls of punch that made the chamber dim with their delicious steam. In easy state upon his couch, there sat a jolly giant, glorious to see, who bore a glowing torch, in shape not unlike Plenty's horn, and held it up, high up, to shed its light on Scrooge as he came peeping round the door. 'Come in,' exclaimed the ghost, 'come in and know me better, man.' Scrooge entered timidly and hung his head before this spirit. He was not the dogged Scrooge he had been, and though the spirit's eyes were clear and kind, he did not like to meet them. 'I am the ghost of Christmas present,' said the spirit. 'Look upon me.' So Scrooge does, and they have their adventures together. And at the end of that stave, Dickens called his chapter Stave, and so in my book, A Carol Dickens Christmas, I went ahead and divided it into 5 staves as well. So at the end of the stave, the ghost of Christmas present, the ghost has Scrooge look under his robes to see the opposite of abundance. From the foldings of its robes it brought 2 children, wretched, abject, frightful, hideous, miserable. They knelt down at its feet and clung to the outside of its garment. 'Oh, man, look here. Look down here,' exclaimed the ghost. They were a boy and girl yellow, meager, ragged, scowling, wolfish, but prostrate too in their humility. Where graceful youth should have filled their features out and touched them with its freshest tints, a stale and shriveled hand like that of age had pinched and twisted them and pulled them into shreds. Where angels might have sat enthroned, devils lurked and glared out menacing. No change, no degradation, no perversion of humanity in any grade. Through all the mysteries of a wonderful creation has monsters half so horrible and dread. And Scrooge started back appalled. Having them shown to him in this way, he tried to say they were fine children, but the words choked themselves rather than be parties to a lie of such enormous magnitude. Spirit, are they yours? Scrooge could say no more. They are man's, said the spirit, looking down upon them, and they cling to me, appealing from their fathers. This boy is ignorance, this girl is want. Beware them both, and all their degree, but most of all beware this boy, for on his brow I see that written which is doom, unless the writing be erased. Deny it, cried the spirit, stretching out its hand towards the city. Slander those who tell it ye, admit it for your factious purposes, and make it worse, and bide the end. Well, he's talking about Scrooge's refusal to be generosity, to be generous, to share his generosity, to share abundance. And that's a big part of what the food means in Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. And, of course, shared abundance has something to do, I think, with food in my novel, A Carol Dickens Christmas, as well. I'm Tom Averill, talking to you about A Carol Dickens Christmas here at High Plains Public Radio. Another food item that gets in the book is hardly Victorian. It has to do with tamales. And the tradition of tamales in my family and in Topeka, I grew up in Topeka, Kansas, and my father was the clinical director, a psychiatrist, and trained at Menninger Foundation in Topeka. And then the state paid for his education if he would give some time back to the state. He gave 17 years back as the clinical director of Boys Industrial School, which is now the youth center at Topeka. And there, he had an extremely diverse staff that we came to know well. And at Christmas, one of the families that worked there, the Hidalgos, would bring my father tamales, the dessert ones that were filled with nuts and raisins and were so good. And, of course, early on, my family and I ate at many of the Mexican restaurants in Topeka, Kansas. And I modeled the restaurant in my novel, which is called Rosario's, after one of the oldest Mexican restaurants in Topeka, La Siesta, which is over in the Oakland neighborhood on Atchison Street. And it had been in operation since 1955. I got to Topeka in 1954, just in time for that to open. So just last year, the family announced the closing of the restaurant, breaking many hearts in Topeka. But Frank and Connie Herrera had to retire at some time. I want to read to you Finn and Gabriella's first visit to Rosario's. Gabriella appeared on her porch, looking happy to see Finn. Did you know my father would be away today? She asked him. Did you know I'd come by? You are one of the okay boys, she said. I'm headed to Rosario's, said Finn. She won't tell on me. Gabriella went inside for the long coat that buttoned only so far down and then hung like a cape. Rosaria is my godmother, she said. She says she's known me too long to turn her back on me like all the others. Finn helped Gabriella hop a missing stair. I didn't know for sure why you weren't in school. You can see, she said. I saw the other night. He offered her his gloves and stuffed his hands in his pockets. They walked the four blocks to the restaurant without talking. Finn didn't want to pry. He didn't really know why he'd walked by. He sure didn't know she'd be waiting for him. Rosaria greeted them warmly and started to seat them both in a booth. Gabriella shook her head and pointed to her huge womb. Por cierto, Rosario smiled. ¿Cómo estás, coneja? Bien, said Gabriella. ¿Y grande? ¿Y lista? Before Rosario could hand them menus, Finn said, One each of the tamales, please. Lo mismo, said Gabriela. Y agua, por favor. Rosaria hurried to the kitchen to shout their order. She greeted customers. December was her busy month. Soon the restaurant would be full. Topekans loved her tamales. In the December cold, nobody wanted to wait long in the lines that could snake down the sidewalk in front of her restaurant. So Rosaria bustled to be sure people were warmly seated, fed, satisfied, and then quickly helped out the door. Finn and Gabriela, shy with each other, sat and watched her. I wish she was my mother, said Gabriela. Their server came with water. Gabriela bit off the paper end of the straw wrapper and shot the rest of the tube at Finn. He put his hand to his face in mock horror. Your father is selling our house, she said. Finn took his hands from his eyes. What? He didn't know his father owned her property. Why? He's your father, said Gabriela. You could ask him. Their tamales arrived. Finn slowly pulled the corn husk from the masa. The steaming dough, warm, pungent, comforting, took his mind off his father. My favorite tamale, he said of the chicken. He picked it up, wrapped it in a napkin, and put it in the pocket of his sweatshirt jacket. It's tamal, Gabriela said. Tamales is plural, but tamal is singular, unless you're totally gringo. She reached over the table and slapped his shoulder to show she was teasing. But if it's your favorite, she asked, why are you putting it in your pocket? You could get a doggy bag. It is for my dog, said Finn. Scraps loves these more than anything in the world. We had a dog that liked tamales, said Gabriela. Algodón, cotton, Finn remembered. A little white dog. I met him when I picked you up freshman year when we went to that band concert. How can you remember? Asked Gabriela. How can you forget, Finn teased her. You were the reason I took Spanish, you know. Gabriela smiled. How is Algodón? Finn asked. Someone ran over him. Didn't even pick him up off the street. That's tough, said Finn. Scraps is dying. Bad tumors all over. Your father could help my family, Gabriela whispered. He came to our house the other day, Gabriela said, to tell us he was selling. My father wants to buy the house, but he has no money. He asked your father to sell it over time, with no down payment. That doesn't sound like something Caldwell Dunmore would do, said Finn. My father blew up at him. He explodes about everything. I think it's because of me. Gabriela's eyes teared up. To him, I am nothing but a whore. Una puta, said Finn. Parents. He shook his head. Maybe you could talk to your father. Help convince him about the house. I guess I'll see him at the winter band concert. You guess? Gabriela scooted her chair from the table and went to the bathroom. Finn finished his beef tamal, then drank his water. Gabriela stayed away for a long time. When she returned, her eyes were swollen from her tears. I must get home, said Gabriela. My father, when he's gone, he calls sometimes to make sure I'm there. I'll get you a doggy bag. No, said Gabriela. She picked up her dessert tamal and took it to a small table by the cash register. Rosaria's blind father, Juan, sat there most days listening to the radio, smiling when someone called his name. Gabriela put the tamales on his plate and whispered something in his ear. A smile creased the old man's face, and he nodded. When Gabriela started away, he called to her. She returned. He reached out his hand and touched her swollen belly as though he could see. Pronto, he said, otro bebé, in the world. Mouth to smile, legs to run, mind to think. The world waits. Yo también, said Gabriela. I'm Tom Averill, reading from A Carol Dickens Christmas, talking particularly about food in this segment. This is Tom Averill joining you here at High Plains Public Radio to talk about A Carol Dickens Christmas, High Plains Public Radio book club selection for December. And in this segment, I'd like to talk just a little bit about one of the themes of the book, which is really the transitions versus the traditions that runs all the way through the book. I might mention before we start into some of that one of Carol's transitions after her divorce is to try to celebrate Christmas in a different and meaningful way for her. And one way that she learns to do this is by adopting Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol as sort of her manual on the perfect Christmas. And fortunately, her former boss, the Lawrence Timmons, back when Caldwell Dunmore divorces Carol Dickens, decides to send her to London around Christmas time to see all the Dickens sights. And since Dickens created Christmas, what better thing to do than go to London? I have to admit, without bragging, that I did the same thing myself. My wonderful university, Washburn University, supported me with an international travel grant and a research grant and had a wonderful time. And I wrote some of that into the book, just so you can get a sense of what Dickens' London is like around Christmas time. Though jet-lagged, Carol and Finn plunged eagerly into London. They found a few pubs where Dickens had sat with friends, even sometimes written his work. They walked past the Athenaeum on Pall Mall, a club Dickens frequented. They found the intersection of Marylebone and Marylebone High Street and studied the stone bas-relief on a building there, placed in honor of Dickens' residence at the site. He'd written six of his novels, including Christmas Carol, there. Finn recognized Scrooge and the door knocker with Marley's face, if nothing else. They found the Dickens House Museum on Doughty Street and climbed up and down the stairs from the library in the basement to the special exhibit on the third floor. Charles Dickens walked these same streets, these same paths, through these same gardens, they said their tour guide the next day. She was costumed as Mrs. Cratchit, dressed out but poorly in a twice-turned gown, she said. Of course, everything has changed. London is not the change. Carol found it hard to imagine Dickens or any of his characters, nephew Fred, Cratchit, Tiny Tim, Fezziwig, walking where she and Finn walked. Still, she dragged Finn along as she combed her guidebook in search of Dickens' life, his books, his Christmas. One afternoon, she armored herself with a pocket street guide and a literary London book that promised a self-guided Dickens London walk. They set off into the misty air. Streets changed names with each step they took. A single street might trick them, suddenly veering to become a court, a place, a square, a close, a muse. They spent half their time ducking into storefronts to consult in London A to Z. When they finally reached somewhere mentioned in the guidebook, like as not the place wasn't real, it had once been the home of London's poorest, or London's Italian quarter, or the site of a prison, tavern, or tenement in which one of Dickens' characters, Oliver Twist, say, had joined with Fagin, who was named, according to the book, after a young man Dickens had worked with during the humiliation of his youthful employment in the blacking factory. Of course, almost everything had once been and did not exist now. The Italian quarter was nothing but low-slung warehouses. The Holborn Hill of Oliver Twist had been torn down to make Holborn Viaduct. The site of Newgate Prison was now the site of Central Criminal Court, Old Bailey. Carol pointed out the clock on St. Andrew's Church at Holborn Circus, mentioned by Dickens in Oliver Twist. "I'm thirsty," Finn said. "You're a dear," said Carol. "I'm suddenly pooped." They found a pub, dark inside, with intricately cut wood from floor to vaulted ceiling. They sat in a booth opposite a big box that was a wood-burning stove. Finn craned his neck, reading signs for beers, brews, ales, stouts, and lagers for biscuits and cigarettes and teas. "Did Charles Dickens ever come in here?" Finn asked. Carol erupted, laughing so hard she began to cry. She held a handkerchief to her face. After a minute, she composed herself. "Dickens here," she said. "Probably. Wasn't he everywhere?" She tried to smile. "And isn't he exactly nowhere?" She pointed to her guidebook. "Dickens' London is gone, replaced by roads and viaducts and modern buildings, ugly ones at that. You saw those monstrosities obscuring St. Paul's, my God." She put her head in her hands. "I don't know if Lawrence Timmons sent me here to discover Dickens or to discover Dickens' absence." "You keep telling me we're walking where Dickens walked," Finn reminded her. "And where thousands of other people walked, George Orwell and Charles Darwin and Emmeline Pankhurst, the British suffragist, and now Finn Dickens Dunmore. Now that you've walked here, can we go home?" Are we going to read a Christmas carol like you promised? I don't know, said Carol. She finished her tea. She stood up and dumped the guidebook into her purse. You promised, said Finn. I have to prepare for the conference. You're bad, said Finn. I'm not bad, I just feel bad, said Carol. I expected at least a little bit more of the trappings of Charles Dickens and A Christmas Carol. I didn't expect anything, said Finn. But I know where A Christmas Carol is, said Finn. It's back at the hotel, and we're reading it. Maybe, said Carol. Now come on. Finn refused to move. Do you remember the Grinch? He whispered so Carol bent down to hear him. And when he stole Christmas, it didn't matter to the Who's, right? Remember how they sang anyway? Of course. You're a bad Who, said Finn. You're just a bad old Who. You're right, Carol shook her head. I wish I had Christmas in my heart, like those Who's. I really wish I did. Well, they're just words on a page, said Finn, speaking like his teachers might, like Carol might. And all you have to do is read those words. This is Tom Averill, High Plains Public Radio, visiting here with book selection of Carol Dickens' Christmas, and that's a passage about Carol and Finn. And the first time they read A Christmas Carol out loud to each other in London. Of course, gifts are important in a Christmas book, and they come in many forms. And early in the novel, Lawrence Timmons challenges Carol to give Finn the gift of her own happiness, if she can start being happy, he says. Finn gives the gift of his help to Gabriella, his friend. Finn gives the gift of his help to Gabriella. Together, they weather a storm. In one conversation, Gabriella tells how her mother and father met. Her mother and father had parents who were neighbors in their village in Mexico. One day, a carnival came and settled for a stay just outside the village on a flat place by the river. They put up a huge Ferris wheel and let the girls of the town ride for free, accompanied by one of the carnival hands. The town soon found out why. The carnival men below stopped the seat with the girl in it at the highest point of the wheel, and the man who accompanied her would comfort the girl in her fear, hugging her and worse. Soon all the young women of the town were forbidden from the wheel. Only Gabriella's mother, Caterina, had not had a ride. She sneaked away to the river. Roberto watched her and sneaked after, and when the seat stopped so high, the men shouted up that the wheel was broken, and soon Roberto heard Caterina's insistence that she not be touched, and finally a scream. Roberto climbed the wheel as though it was a ladder, and when he came to the top, he climbed into the seat. He did not try to harm the man with Caterina. Instead, he looked out over the whole town and said, Que vista, no? And the wheel began to rotate. He was a gentle man back then, said Gabriella, before all the children, before my mother died from an infection soon after I was born, before we came to the United States, then finally to Kansas. Maybe he will become a gentleman again, said Finn. Having been her mother's protector and then having her protect him during their marriage, the loss of her has been a terrible blow to Roberto, and he feels badly about his daughter's pregnancy because he has not helped her avoid it, as perhaps her mother could. Anger is his first response, but he can give another response. In fact, his love and acceptance is one of the gifts he can give to his daughter. Another gift, one that Carol gives Lawrence, has meaning to Dickens. Here's a passage from the novel. Then, as Carol had planned, he'd seen an old truck wandering down the street, and the rack on the back of the pickup would be festooned with ladders, buckets, long-handled brushes, and when the truck pulled into Lawrence's driveway, he would see the driver, an old man in a small hat with a red feather, frizzled gray hair springing from beneath it. The truck's door would be decorated with a top hat and brush, with the simple word sweep below it. The old man, Harry Marvel, would open the door, jump nimbly to the driveway, and Lawrence would have to wheel to the door to answer the persistent bell. He would reach forward to the knob, swing the door open, and back away in his chair. "Remember me?" the old man would ask cheerfully. "Harry Marble." And the old man would open the screen door and step in. "Time you had a fire, good sir. Take the chill off of December." "I didn't send for you," Lawrence would say. His chair would no doubt block Mr. Marble's passage into the house. "Still, I am sent," Mr. Marble would say, "in the spirit of a Christmas present, sir. Now show me to the fireplace." And Lawrence would let him in, and Mr. Marble would check the damper and go outside to climb the roof and do his magic with brush and bucket and secure the chimney cap and clean the firebox with broom and shop vac and find the rotting wood pile and supplement the soft wood with some good oak from the back of his truck and grab the sports section of the Topeka Capital Journal from the passenger seat and start a fire to check the draw of the chimney. And when the wood caught, he'd sit by the fire, Lawrence now wheeling close to the hearth. And as Carol had directed him, Mr. Barble would say, "Now everything is cricket." Surely Lawrence would remember Dickens' Christmas novel, The Cricket on the Hearth, about the older man with the young wife who loses confidence that he is his wife's one true love, even that he is lovable at all. In the end, he is restored to confidence and sits at last content in front of his own hearth, crickets chirping his very happiness. To cement the association, Carol had asked Mr. Marble to deliver a little metal cricket, which he would take out of his pocket and place on the brick hearth. The piece was so cleverly made that the metal expanded and shrank in response to the fire, making clicking and scraping sounds, almost cricket-like, almost real. I'm Tom Averill, reading from A Carol Dickens Christmas, my novel and the book club selection of High Plains Public Radio. In this novel, Finn also finds an appropriate gift for Carol. He uses a nest that was nestled in their disorderly Christmas tree, and here's how he delivers it to his mother. This is Christmas Eve. Carol set her alarm for the middle of the night. She thought she heard Finn's alarm, and then suspected she was anticipating her own. She went to the kitchen and put the turkey in a slow oven, then returned to bed. She liked nothing better than waking slowly on Christmas morning to the rich aroma of a baking bird. Instead, she was startled by the blast of a trumpet. Finn in the upstairs hall. Had he already been downstairs and found the silver Bach trumpet under the tree? He played short, clear notes, up, then down, then back up, and Carol felt like a queen being awakened by court musicians. After the first clean phrase, Finn elaborated with triplets and flutterings, moving high and low, but always returning to the royal sound at the end of the phrase. Then, after jazzing the music with bends and high notes that fell instantly to the bottom of the scale, Finn repeated his original melody. "Wonderful!" Carol shouted. She hurried out of bed and threw on a robe. Majestic! She threw up in the window to see a clear morning, the sky almost white with light. Ice dripped everywhere, as silver and liquid as the horn she'd bought for Finn, as the notes he'd played on the new trumpet. That was such fun. Carol opened the door. Finn stood in the hall, silver Bach in hand, smiling. "My project," said Finn. "Well, it was beautiful. Do you have the music written out?" Carol gave him a hug. Finn hugged her back. He went to his room and brought out the nest they'd found in their forlorn Christmas tree. The woven collage of sticks and scraps was full of little pieces of paper, and on each a musical note. "I call it Fanfare for Carol Dickens," said Finn. "All the notes are there." "Well, you arranged them wonderfully when you played." Carol took the nest, like birds, singing a song. "For you," said Finn. "Your music has always been a gift." I'm Tom Averill, reading from my novel, A Carol Dickens Christmas. In this novel, traditions, as they are for everyone at Christmas, are important, especially at the holidays, but But transitions become important in the novel as well. And in a novel, I think the transition of each character from one state of being to another, from one place to another, from one state of mind to another, from one disposition to another, is important. In A Carol Dickens Christmas, all the characters have a chance to grow and to change and to redeem themselves. Finn grows up. Carol accepts both the looming empty nest and the attentions of Lawrence. Lawrence is ready for his next step, quite literally. Gabriella makes good decisions and is accepted by her father. Even Finn's father, who has divorced Carol Dickens 7 years before, whom Carol thinks Dickens would describe like he describes Scrooge. There's that wonderful passage in A Christmas Carol in which Dickens starts out by saying, "Oh, he was a tight-fisted man at the, you know," and goes on and on about Scrooge. And here's how Carol would imitate that, imagining how Dickens would write, "He was a selfish man, a mean, tight-hearted, clutch-fisted man, thin as gruel, just short enough to worry about his size, just vain enough to trim his mustache to as thin a pencil as he was, just pompous enough to include a self-addressed stamped envelope to force replies to his formal proposals, first of separation, then divorce, and now divestment of his properties." She wonders what she ever saw in the man. And yet, the father comes through in this book to be of some help. And of course, the dog, Scraps, makes his transition, naturally and inevitably. But all comes to peace during this season of peace. A Carol Dickens Christmas is really about people who unite as a community of people to create networks and to help each other. Mr. Harry Marble is at the center, like a magi or a magician. I call him a wise guy, too, making sure that everyone uses their gifts properly. I remember thinking that he might know things because he's been at the chimneys of so many people. So one evening when he happens to be riding along, he notices Finn walking and he picks him up. It's after the mariachi rehearsal. Here's their encounter. Finn started home in increasing snow. By the time he reached the Topeka Avenue Bridge, his footprints were scrunching into an inch of slush and his hair and eyelashes were crusted with large wet flakes. He stopped to put his hood up and his gloves on. A familiar truck pulled up to the curb next to him and the door swung open. "Hop in," said Mr. Marble. A car honked behind the truck. Finn hurried into the seat and swung the door shut as Mr. Marble stepped on the gas and started over the bridge. "Your mother awaits," said Mr. Marble. "My mother sent you?" Finn looked out the window at the twilight snow, at the slushy river with its darkening sandbars, at the Union Pacific tracks, a slow train of coal cars snaking its way through a curve before heading west on what would be nothing but straightaway. Mr. Marble was silent. "She knows where I am?" Finn asked. "Nobody knows where you are, except for you," said Mr. Marble. Finn smiled. Such was Mr. Marble, enigmatic, maybe even a little crazy. "How's the chimney business?" asked Finn. "Never been better. Got a special contract," said Mr. Marble. "Santa Claus himself, tired of all the dirty chimneys he is. So I'm busy." "It must be hard in this weather," said Finn. "It's a hard time of year," said Mr. Marble. "Take your mother. She's feeling it, isn't she?" "Feeling what?" "The dark, the cold, the loneliness, when people aren't there for her." "Did she talk to you or something?" asked Finn. "I hear things I do," said Mr. Marble. "I'm a chimney sweep. I've an ear for what's going on up and down the rooftops and the chimneys that connect the roofs to the rooms and to the hearts of those inside them." I'm Tom Averill, reading from A Carol Dickens Christmas. That was character Mr. Harry Marble, a chimney sweep, talking to one of the main characters, Finn. Finn has a moment in the novel, when he's at a jazz performance at his school, his last semester, his last performance. And it's a moment where a lot of his separate plots seem to get together and frighten him, a sort of a Ghost of Christmas Future, if you will. It frightened him by the how much he sees that they're all part of one sort of chaotic community that the novel explores. I'll read you a passage from the book. Jazz band swing night was Mr. Riley's idea of fun. Instead of performing on a stage, the kids turned the cafeteria into a kind of dance hall usually created for them at the small town middle and high schools where they played during the year. Instead of sitting, quietly listening, parents and friends found partners. After some hesitancy in the adults as well as the high school kids, most everyone danced. Freshman year, Finn wondered if Carol would go by herself and end up asking some married guy to dance. Instead, at the last minute, she'd invited Lawrence Timmons, and they danced enough to participate, not enough to be a center of attention. Finn was not relieved this year when Lawrence wheeled into the cafeteria. Carol hadn't said he was coming. You wouldn't invite a guy in a wheelchair to a dance. During the first number, Finn looked out at the dance floor and saw Gabriella's Aunt Teresa dressed in a flouncing sequin skirt, dancing with someone. In the muted light, Finn thought for an instant the man might be Gabriella's father. Worried, he missed a cue. Mr. Riley, the director, stared him down. After intermission, during a slow number Finn knew by heart, Carol pulled Lawrence into the dance floor. Not everyone had begun dancing again, and Lawrence's wheelchair was conspicuous. Carol stood in front of Lawrence and shifted her weight from side to side. Lawrence moved first one wheel, then the next, slightly forward, then back. He moved his head to the beat, occasionally raised one arm, and then the other from the wheels of his chair. At first, Finn felt embarrassed, but Lawrence's smooth movements and abandoned smile forced Finn to forget what people might think. Lawrence was feeling the music, something Mr. Riley always cajoled his students to do. Finn watched, amused, until Teresa tapped his mother on the shoulder and cut in. Carol nodded and found a seat at the edge of the room. Maybe Finn was tired from staying up late the night before. Maybe it was the heat in the cafeteria, all the bodies dancing, the school furnace turned up too high. Maybe he was seeing things, but he thought he saw Mr. Marble come in the door and take a seat in the back, and soon after, Gabriella and her father arrived. Had Mr. Marble dragged them here, or had they dragged Mr. Marble? And then Caldwell Dunmore, his father, walked into the cafeteria, found Finn's mother, and asked her to dance, and they were talking, too? Finn was in a nightmare. His tangled relationships, each separate, looked as though they might weave together. The jazz band began their last number. Finn began to sweat. He debated running from the room. As the band held the last wavering note of the last song of the evening, Finn closed his eyes, and Scraps leaned his head into Finn's shoulder and whimpered, his wet fur brushing Finn's hair, his eyes full of unshed tears. The sensation was so real, Finn almost wept. When the last note faded into applause, Finn suddenly woke from his reverie. The lights were bright again. He stood up and waved at his mother, at Lawrence, at Teresa, at Gabriella, and her father, at Mr. Marble, at his father. Finn set his horn on his chair and walked onto the floor. So that's the coming together and the weaving. And it strikes me now, you know, when you're a novelist, and I'm Tom Averill, who wrote a Carol Dickens Christmas, but, you know, at first I've explained to you how Carol's in transition and she's studying transitions and she studies punctuation. And it's funny that as I was working on this novel for a long period of time, punctuation and the semicolon just seemed like a good device in the novel. But by the time I finished the novel, they had really come together as sort of central to the whole meaning of the book. And at the very end of the novel, the significance of all of this and the interweaving of the plots, I try to make it clear. It's finally Twelfth Night, January 6th, the 12th day of Christmas, and they're having a big party at the house to celebrate all the transitions and all the transitions of the book, the traditions and transitions that make up really the biggest part of the novel. At the end of the evening, Carol made a toast. She stood next to Lawrence. "This Christmas," she said, "has been a time of great transitions. I look forward to the new as much as I have relished the old. But like Scrooge, I promise to always live in the present, as a baby does." "Hear, hear," shouted Lawrence Timmons. "God bless the end of this long sentence." "No," said Carol Dickens. "No end punctuation. No periods." The others in the room would not understand her, but she didn't care. "Allow me," she said, "to toast the semicolon." She raised her glass. "The go-between of clauses and meanings. The transition mark that tells us there is more to come. The signal that promises all shall be joined in meaning. To semicolons used and still to be used. God bless them, everyone." In fact, the semicolon connects two independent clauses. Two clauses that could actually stand alone as sentences. The writer makes a choice. He wants those two independent clauses in the same sentence because they are so closely connected in thought and idea and movement. Carol is an independent person, yet she is in the same sentence with Finn, with Scraps, with Marvel, with Lawrence, with her ex-husband Caldwell, with Gabriella, and her family. Dickens took this as one of his major themes in his work, that we are all connected, that we are all indeed fellow passengers to the grave, and should be treated with dignity, respect, warmth, and even love. And that is exactly what I was trying for in my novel, A Carol Dickens Christmas. I'm Tom Averill, and I'm happy that High Plains Public Radio has selected A Carol Dickens Christmas to read at this season of the year, one of my favorite times of the year, and I hope one of yours as well. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Tom Averill, author of A Carol Dickens Christmas. This is the holiday read of our brand new High Plains Public Radio Readers Book Club. You can learn more about this novel and the book club on our website, hppr.org. This is a special production of High Plains Public Radio. A Carol Dickens Christmas was written and voiced by Thomas Fox Averill and produced by Cindy Talley.